Brad Lancaster is the author of Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands, Volume 1. He spoke at the Las Vegas Springs Preserve on October 24, 2006. For more information, please visit harvestingrainwater.com.
What I'll be talking to you guys about tonight is water harvesting, both rainwater and graywater harvesting. And I'm going to show you how you can do it as told through the story of an African water farmer. Now you might be thinking, wait a minute, we're in Vegas, why are you talking about Africa? It's because all the principles that he integrated into his site are directly applicable to any site anywhere. There's 8 universal principles. The way you realize the principles will vary depending on where you are. Every site's unique. And both the simplicity and the complexity of water harvesting is it is always site specific. I will tell the story of the African water farmer told against the backdrop of the water situation in my hometown of Tucson, Arizona, where we get 12 inches of rain in an average year. Because I think the water situation in Tucson... Yeah. Well, you're still doing all right. But the water situation in Tucson, I think, is definitely applicable to what's going on in Vegas as well. And I will pepper the talk with examples not only of Africa, but also the water situation in the southwestern United States and examples of water harvesting there. So we start off looking at a picture of Tucson, Arizona in the early 1900s. So as you can see here, we used to have a perennially flowing river. It was a braided flow, not a channelized flow. And alongside this river that used to run year-round, we had a thick bosque or thick forest of mesquite trees, cottonwood, willows, and beyond the floodplain, here you see the old adobe buildings, and then beyond that, we still had a rather rich, though more xeric, sponge of living vegetation. So back then, because of this vegetation, when the raindrops fell from the sky, the erosive force of the falling drops would be broken up by the canopy. And then as the water traveled more slowly through the canopy of the vegetation, it was readily absorbed by a mulchy layer of organic matter below. So back then, more of the water, more of the rainfall would infiltrate than would run off the surface. This is another photograph taken of my hometown in the early 1900s. This time we're looking a little further south of the previous one you saw. Again, we can see some large swaths of native mesquite forests along the meandering river, still with perennial flow. But we're starting to see some of the mesquite forest being replaced with agricultural fields. Now, the native forests are much more of a dynamic living sponge than the agricultural fields, but nonetheless, the fields too act as a living sponge, especially when in crop. And now just burn this image into your mind, and we're going to jump 80 years to the future and how it still pretty much looks today. So you can see we've lost the river. It stopped running perennially in the 1940s. We've also lost countless springs, and the groundwater table, which used to be at about 20 feet beneath the surface in the early 1900s, is now over 300 feet beneath the surface and continues to drop at a rate of 3 to 4 feet per year. Not only have we killed the river, but we've also greatly narrowed and straightened and channelized the once more meandering flow. So that's all we have left of the meander now. As a result, we have a lot more flooding downstream than we did before because water rips through the system much more quickly than it did. But you're saying, yeah, but it's a dead river. Well, when it flows is only during and immediately after large storm events. And then it's got much more of a peak flash flood flow than it ever did before. And that's in large part because along with killing the river, we have paved the bulk of the watershed. The mesquite forests you saw in the previous slide, they're now gone. And they've been replaced with the pavement of asphalt streets, parking lots, buildings, concrete sidewalks, and driveways. Officially, over 25% of Tucson is currently paved. That's only looking at the official pavement. The unofficial pavement includes the large swaths of devegetated areas where the soil has now been compacted to such a degree that it acts like an adobe brick patio. while we get 12 inches of rain falling in an average year, we're lucky if even 1 inch actually infiltrates the soil. We are literally dehydrating the watershed. We are literally creating desertification and making for a much more arid, a much more hot climate in our urban city. I'm going to give you a few more doom and gloom statistics, and just to put everything in context, and then we'll jump to the happy water harvesting stuff. While we simultaneously cripple the watershed's ability to naturally recharge the groundwater, and then we simultaneously over-extract or deplete, you know, pump out the groundwater at a more rapid rate than natural recharge, we have chosen to ignore that problem and the cause of the problem, the cause of our dwindling water resources. They're primarily the mismanagement of the watershed and the over-extraction of our groundwater. And instead, we've chosen a political solution which lets us ignore the cause, and we have put in the Central Arizona Water Project, which costs us over $4 billion to construct and costs us over $80 million a year to operate. What that is it's an open canal that takes water from the Colorado River and pumps it 300 miles from river to Tucson and over 3,000 feet uphill. Tucson is not 3,000 feet above the Colorado, but what happens is the water goes through the canal to a pump station. It's pumped up, and then via gravity it goes down to another pump station. You add all the pump stations up and their elevation of pumping, and you get 3,000 feet. While this cost us a lot of money to put in, it's costing a lot of money to run. That $80 million a year of operation fees, the bulk of that is going to pay the electric bill. And here's the kicker. Since we get the bulk of our electricity, well over 98%, from the burning of coal, for every kilowatt hour of electricity we consume, we are consuming from a half gallon to 20 gallons of water per kilowatt hour used. So this PowerPoint presentation is consuming water, but nowhere near as much as the pumping of the water. One other thing about the Colorado. As we deplete our groundwater table, the water quality gets worse. It becomes more salty. It gets more costly to pump it up. But the salt content of our groundwater doesn't come close to that of the Colorado River. For every acre foot of Colorado River water we import 2,000 pounds of salt. And that's a killer in the desert environment, because we have alkaline soils that are already salty. And as we apply this salty water, the salts remain while the water evaporates or gets evapotranspired by plant. So the salt levels of the soil continually accumulate when we use groundwater or surface water for our irrigation. So the fertility of the soil steadily declines, because the saltier the soil, the harder it is for plants to uptake the water and the harder it is for plants to photosynthesize. But if you instead irrigate primarily with salt-free rainwater, you steadily leach the salts out of the root zone of the plant without introducing any new salts. And this way, over time, you can steadily improve the fertility of the soil and steadily improve the drought tolerance of the vegetation, the opposite of irrigating with groundwater or surface water. Michael Avenari in the Negev Desert of Israel did a number of studies, and he took fields that were so salted up, nothing could be grown, not even halophytes. But by implementing water harvesting earthworks, he was able to leach the salts out of the root zone of the soil to such a degree that he could then grow crops that were not even moderately salt tolerant after 7 years. Now, you go to a wetter climate of Atlanta, Georgia, you see how much of the surface has been paved there and how much water they are now losing. They're losing over 130 billion gallons of water a year, rainwater, that used to infiltrate the soil, recharge springs, creeks, aquifers, and wells. Now that's being lost. It's enough water to support over 3.5 million households. So you say, yeah, that's a wet climate. What about the dry climate? Well, let's come back to Tucson, Arizona. So we get 12 inches of rain in an average year of rainfall. It's amazing how much rain there is. You know, people laugh when they hear I harvest rain in the desert. They say, what rain do you harvest? Every drop that falls. If you get 1 inch of rain falling on a 1,000 square foot surface, say a roof of a small house, That's 600 gallons of water per inch of rain. If you look at a 1 acre site, you're getting 27,000 gallons of water per inch of rain falling on that site. There's a lot of rain if we choose to recognize it as a resource and if we hold on to it rather than allowing it to run off or evaporate off. We did an interesting calculation. We looked at the average water consumption of the average Tucsonan, which is 165 gallons of water per person per day. It's higher here in Vegas. We then looked at how much rain falls on the surface area of Tucson in an average year, and we divided that by the population. We found out that you get over 235 gallons of rain falling on the surface area of Tucson per person per day if you allocate it over the year. So there's more rain falling on the surface area of Tucson than we currently consume of our groundwater and imported Colorado River water. But the problem is, we don't even recognize it as a water source. We look at it as a liability. Now, I'm not saying that we should be getting all our water from rainwater, but what I am saying is we should recognize it and utilize it as a major source of water. Actually, our highest quality source of water. Rainwater has no salt. It's a natural fertilizer with nitrogen and also phosphates and whatnot. And it's naturally distilled water. So it's got much fewer total dissolved solids, or TDS, than our groundwater, and far, far less than Colorado River water. I harvest every drop, and I make it 12. I'll point out how you do that in just a moment. So this is another photograph of the Santa Cruz River. This photograph was taken in the 1940s. This is the only stretch of the river you can see because the living sponge of cottonwoods, willows, mesquites, and so on is so thick that that's all is visible. Now look at this boulder and look at this saguaro. Burn this image into your mind, and this very thick forest of trees is about to disappear. So just 40 years later, this is what we get. All the trees are gone. We just have stumps and scrub remaining. Since we've lost that vegetative canopy, now topsoil is being lost at a rapid rate, so we have very erosive soils. The riverbed has dropped, and there is no longer perennial flow in the river. This happened in just 40 years, and what killed the forest of vegetation is we over-extracted, we over-pumped our groundwater to such an extent that the roots could no longer access the water. So we lost the vegetation, but unfortunately, we also lost the sponge, and that's the key element that infiltrates the bulk of the rain into the soil to recharge the groundwater. Here's where we have the rivers of today. They're on our streets. It's no wonder we consider stormwater and rainwater a liability. We drain it off the surfaces where it would be a resource, our landscapes, our farm fields, and we shoot it right into the streets where it causes traffic problems and whatnot. For those of you listening on the radio, the slide we just saw was a car driving through a flooded street. It looked more like a river. This slide, we're looking at the water rapidly draining off of the street into a storm drain, and it's kind of like a whitewater rapid. Here, we see that runoff is then being drained quickly out of the system after causing traffic problems. This is leading to a much bigger problem, a hidden problem. We have all kinds of small contaminants throughout the watershed, like pet feces in yards, oil dripping from cars and driveways, and herbicides sprayed in people's gardens. If those were kept on site and managed on site, they wouldn't be an issue. But they're not, because the runoff is not checked. It's not kept on site. That's why it's run off. It's not run in. It is pulling all these contaminants down to the riverbeds and concentrating these small contaminants into a more toxic brew, where we have the most rapid rate of infiltration into our aquifer. And while the river will flow in storm events, it just flows for a matter of hours. It's just a flood drain. It's no longer flowing for months as it used to. So this next slide is then showing that we are living on the wasteful path to scarcity. Here we have a slide of some sickly trees planted on mounds that rapidly drain water and topsoil away, and then all the water accumulates in the gathering areas or the streets to cause flooding problems. So we call this the wasteful path to scarcity because due to our management, or I would say our mismanagement, of the watershed and the system, the natural resources are steadily being depleted. So we get more and more concerned about this as we realize what's going on, and then we're scared to live in the city. Scarcity. But we can easily flip things around and instead live the stewardship path to abundance, where instead of planting on mounds, we plant beside or within basins or water harvesting earthworks that hold on to the rain. And then we raise our access ways, our pathways, our driveways, and patios so our feet stay high and dry, and it drains the water to where it's a resource, the landscape. And in colder climates, this is a benefit because you don't have hazards of ice, because the water is not gathering and freezing on your access ways. So now we get to the story of the African water farmer. I had the opportunity to travel around southern Africa in the mid-1990s. Everywhere I went, when I was checking out sustainable agriculture systems, urban design systems, and whatnot, when people heard I was from Arizona and interested in water, they said, "You've got to go meet the water farmer." I said, "Okay, who is he?" I said, "Well, he's this guy who turns wastelands into oases, and he does so by farming the rain." I didn't know what that meant, but I was hooked. So I sought the guy out, and I found him in the driest region of Zimbabwe, Zvishavane. And there they get about 22 inches of rain in an average year of rainfall. But that's an average based on extremes. So many years they get far less than 10, while other years they can get more than 40. Even the low seems higher than here in Vegas. Still, the concepts and the strategies that were used can definitely be applied here and also used with success, but your plant palette changes. I went up and introduced myself to Mr. Beery, the water farmer, and he was sitting on the stoop of a very simple mud building reading the Bible, which I later found out was his gardening manual. So I introduced myself, and he just jumped up, and he started laughing. And he kept laughing the whole time I spent with him. He's one of the happiest guys I've ever met in my life. I think this is because on a daily basis, he's doing lots of work to enhance the local ecosystem in which he lives by revegetating the watershed, checking erosion. And also, he's working daily to enhance the conditions for the local human community by creating job programs and showing people how to grow their own food and create more sustainable systems. So he's daily getting positive affirmation for his good works, and I think it's tough to have a bad attitude when that's happening. Along with laughing a lot, he told many great stories, and the best of all was his own, and this is his story. In 1964, he was fired from his job working for the Rhodesian Railroad. At that time, Zimbabwe was called Rhodesia, named after Cecil Rhodes. Mr. Peary was a black African, and he was striving for democratic reform. He wanted everyone to have equal say regardless of skin color or background. Because of this, he was blacklisted by the all-white minority government and told he'd never work again in any sector, public or private. So he had to figure out some way to support his family of eight. And he turned to the only two things he felt he had to get him out of the bind. One was his small family landholding of about 7 acres. But the problem with this land, it was so eroded and so degraded, the fertility was almost nil, and he had never been able to grow anything of substance. Then he turned to the other thing, the Bible. Reading the story of Genesis, reading the story of Adam and Eve, he came upon his solution. He said, "Here it is, the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve had everything they needed provided by this garden. All I've got to do is to create a Garden of Eden." He was thrilled with the simplicity of the idea, until he thought about it a little bit more. He thought, "No, Adam and Eve had the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in their region. I don't even have an ephemeral creek. So the first thing I've got to do is to create the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that will sustain the garden." And he's actually done this in his own way. And the way he's done this is by following the 8 principles of successful water harvesting, which I lay out in detail in my book, and I'll give you briefly here tonight. And the key is, you can't just pick your favorite principle. You have to apply all of the principles. And the way you apply it will vary with every site, but you must make sure that all 8 principles are inherent in your design. So the first one is long and thoughtful observation. We all are born with these incredible innate skills of observation through which we can learn what we need to know about the site and figure out how we can bring about the needed change. We've got sight, smell, touch, taste, hearing, feeling in our gut and our olfactory senses. We need to use all of these to figure out what's going right and build on that. And then we also need to use these senses to figure out what's not working. We need to change that. And this is what Mr. Peary did. He has no more than a 6th grade formal education, but he didn't use that to figure out how to turn things around. He just used his powers of observation. In his area, it's an area of rolling hills, grassland, the valleys between, and then there's sparse trees with big, broad, open sky above. The piece that is definitely not working about this area is that all the hilltops are bald. The monsoonal or summer rains are so violent that they just wash the bulk of the soil right off the hilltops. So the bulk of what you see is bare bedrock. So that was not working. That was a drain. But what was working were a few pockets here and there where there'd be rocks laid perpendicular to the flow. The rocks would be on contour of the slope, or sometimes it would be fallen branches or sometimes vegetation. And this net cast in the flow was enough to slow down the speed and force of the runoff, just enough that the sediments, the seed, and the organic matter that it carried would settle out behind the net. And it would start to create a sponge on what was otherwise a drain. And Mr. Peary noticed that vegetation would start to grow there, moisture would linger there longer than the areas of unchecked runoff. So that's what he started to mimic. Now, I need to let you all know that these photographs were taken after an 8-month period of no recordable rainfall, and they were taken in winter, so the bulk of the vegetation was dormant. I also feel I need to say to American audiences that Mr. Peary is not striving to be on the cover of Sunset Gardening magazine. He's a subsistence farmer, so he's got very few resources at his disposal. The Zimbabwean economy has been awful, particularly so now. He didn't have much at all to begin with, but yet he's done some amazing things, as you'll see. Okay, the next principle of water harvesting is you want to start at the top of your watershed and work down. So for many of us, the top of our watershed is our roof. And you can put gutters on the eaves of the roof, and then you can direct that water to a cistern or a tank or water harvesting earthworks. If you have a sloped site, I would recommend that you direct the bulk of the water to the high part of the site rather than the low part. That way you can use gravity to freely distribute the water around the rest of the site. In addition, I strongly recommend that you not replicate the conventional pattern of having one or a few stormwater detention retention basins at the bottom of a site, but nothing elsewhere on the site to infiltrate and utilize the water. This model of having a detention retention basin at the bottom, it's not looking at anything but keeping stormwater from flashing off the site. But what it unfortunately does is it creates this landscape that floods within the basin to such a degree that you're very limited as to what you can grow within that basin. And then it drains the rest of the site. So the rest of the site is left high, dry, and dehydrated while the bottom is flooded. We're creating a system of extremes. So what I advocate instead is that you start at the top of your watershed with cisterns, water harvesting earthworks, a combination, and you keep going all the way down to the bottom of the site. So when it rains, the entire site is hydrated and nothing is flooded. If you want to harvest water for drinking, washing, bathing, whatnot, or for having water on hand for high water use plantings like a vegetable garden, then cisterns make a lot of sense. But if you primarily want to use the rainwater to irrigate low water use landscapes, especially those utilizing native plants, don't start with a tank. Maybe never get a tank, because in that instance, if you had a tank, you'd be suffering from tank envy, which is the social phenomenon of wanting the biggest, best tank to show off that you're harvesting the water when you really don't need one. Because earthworks, they store water in the soil, which is our largest and least expensive tank. If we set up the top of the soil to hold on to rather than drain off the water. Here we have some level-bottomed basins beside a house. You want to have these basins at least 10 feet away from the foundation so you don't saturate the water underneath the house. And this way the water freely goes from the roof, collects in the basins, and infiltrates the soil. But you do not want to leave a bare basin. That's an evaporation pan. And that causes a mosquito problem. We don't want that. We want to be part of the mosquito solution. And the way you achieve that is by mulching the bottom of the basin with organic matter, like 4 inches at least of mulch or compost, and then planting within and beside the earthwork. This way you create a living sponge that rapidly infiltrates the water, so you never have standing water for more than 1 hour. Now, people oftentimes ask me, well, what kind of vegetation would you plant within or beside such an earthwork? And when they ask me that, I say, go take a hike! But I mean it in a good way. I want them to take a hike. I want them to go out into the areas where nobody's irrigating, no one's caring for the system. And I want them to see what native vegetation naturally grows within the low spots of the landscape. What vegetation naturally grows along ephemeral, not perennial, ephemeral waterways. Because this, you don't have standing water in here. Just have a little bit of water when the rain comes. That's the vegetation you want to plant within your earthworks. The vegetation you plant beside your earthworks is the vegetation that grows in the high, better draining areas. If you want to plant exotics like fruit trees, well, then refer to the nursery books or nursery staff. Or just to play it safe, keep the root crown, where the trunk of the tree, the root enters the soil, keep that on a high point within or beside the basin, but have the tree close enough to the basin so the roots can easily tap the infiltrating water. Okay? That way you won't have crown rot from the root crown being inundated with water temporarily. Now we've got an image of Mr. Peary's site. So this is the top of the hill. You can see a bare granite bedrock hilltop. Below that, you start to see unmortared stone walls starting near the top of the hill. And as you move down, those walls continue until just above a family compound, there's two reservoirs. Then we get into a fenced family compound where the house is, the outdoor wash area, a courtyard garden, and some additional plantings. We'll just work our way all the way down to the bottom of the site. As we move down, we have some diversion swales the government put in with Mr. Peary's fruition pits, then fields separated by windbreaks planted on contour to harvest runoff, and then we get to three hand-dug wells near the bottom of the site, and finally three reservoirs and a banana plantation. This is an image looking up from the family compound. You can see there are a series of unmortared stone walls. He just gathered whatever rock he had and laid it on contour. He started at the top and worked down. And this slowed the flow of the otherwise unchecked runoff enough that he no longer lost chickens and other small livestock to the runoff flow as he once did. And he started to make the managing of the water more doable. So now we're looking at a slide from the top of the hill down. And again, we can see these low rock walls, no taller than 3 feet. Most of them are 2 feet or shorter, but many are from 30 to 80 feet long. You can see that behind, on the upslope side, behind these walls, soil starting to accumulate and vegetation growing in that soil. So by making these porous stone walls, he slowed the runoff enough that that's accumulated, and he's starting to create sponges on what would otherwise be the drain of the bare bedrock. And then below, you can see the family compound of round adobe buildings with grass-thatched roofs and a simple animal corral, fences made of gathered branches and brush. The next principle of water harvesting is you want to start with small and simple strategies. Why do you want to do that? Well, because it's funner and easier that way, and you'll actually do it. And so starting small and simple can mean just planting low water use native shade trees in or beside a water harvesting earthwork, such as a basin, on the east or west side of your home, not the south. Now, the reason I advocate this is so when the trees grow to maturity, they will shade the east and west facing walls of your home to shade you from the rising and setting sun in the summer months, because the sun rises and sets to the north of due east and due west in the summer months. The bulk of your insulation is not in your walls, and it's certainly not in your windows. It's in your ceiling. That insulation protects you from the noonday sun, but doesn't do you much good at all from the rising and setting sun. But yet, by creating this bank of vegetation on the east and west of your home, you can dramatically shade it and cool it. Why buy an air conditioner when you can grow one? Such plantings on the east and west side of your home can reduce ambient temperatures in summer by up to 20 degrees once the tree is mature. Then you utilize runoff from the roof directed into these earthworks to then be the passive irrigator of that vegetation. If you want fruit trees to be on the east and west side of your home, go ahead and do that, but only if you're also sending household gray water to those same basins. So we're back to Africa, and this is Mr. Peary standing in a reservoir just a little bit deeper than him. And this is the first spot on his site where the steep slope became more gradual. So instead of soil continually eroding away, it started to deposit. It was here that he finally had soil into which he could dig. So he dug out this reservoir, dug it all the way down to the bedrock, so that water could be collected and then infiltrate into the soil banks. I understood all this, but I didn't understand why he called this his immigration center. So I asked him about it, and he said, oh, it's because this is where I stand, atop the reservoir, not within it, when the rain falls from the sky. And I shout out to the rain, rain, welcome to my country. Now I'm going to tell you where you will live, in the soil. And he really does this. I confirmed it with the neighbors. He wants the water in the soil, not on top of the soil, because then it's productive rather than destructive, because it moves very slowly. If it's running over the surface, it's erosive. Also, if it's within the soil rather than on top of the soil, he loses far less of it to evaporation. And this is not only his immigration center, it's also his rain gauge. He knows if he fills this three times in a season, he has enough water stored throughout the soils of his site's watershed because of the reservoir, the rock walls, and many other strategies you'll see from the top to the bottom to last him through a two-year drought. He knows this because he's lived through one since he's implemented these strategies. As we then walked on to the next part of the site, he started shouting out his rallying cry of, down with runoff, up with soaking! He's really into this concept, but it's really worked well for him. So the next principle of water harvesting is you want to slow spread and sink the flow of water. Or said another way, you want to slow spread and infiltrate the flow of water. So this particular image we're looking at does not represent that. Instead, this represents a landscape on intensive care. And unfortunately, it's a typical landscape pattern throughout the western United States, where we are planting on burial mound-like hills, so the water, topsoil, and organic matter rapidly drains away. And then we take the roof runoff via a downspout, and then we send it typically in these river cobble-looking drainage ways, and the water goes right past the plants and into the street where it's a flooding liability, and then the sediment that it's carrying out of our yard is a problem in the storm drains for the municipality. Since we so rapidly drain off the resources and the fluids, we need to then import them from elsewhere with these intravenous-like drip irrigation emitters that replace the fluids we've drained off. And then we have to bring in care packages of costly manufactured fertilizer to replace the nutrients we've drained away. We can easily move from this wasteful path of scarcity to the stewardship path to abundance by instead planting within or beside bowl-like earthworks that retain the runoff rather than draining them off the landscape. So we then send the water off the roof into a downspout into these basins or behind a contour berm or within a series of terraces on a slope site. Basins work great on a flat site. And then the water has to fill the basin before it can overflow to another one, and then maybe overflow to another after that. And then once all the earthworks are filled with water, then the overflow can go to the street and the storm drain. But the difference is it's only the overflow. It's not all the flow. What's more, by doing this, you can dramatically enhance the available rainfall. So you all get about 4 inches of rain in an average year here in Vegas. Is that correct? Okay. When it falls. So let's say this is a landscape in Las Vegas. Because this landscape is utilizing earthworks, it gets at least 12 inches of rain a year in Las Vegas. That's an average year of rainfall. How is that possible? The way it's possible is because 4 inches is falling from the sky directly onto the landscape for 4 inches of rain. Then we have about the same surface area as the landscape in the form of the roof. There's another 4 inches of rain falling on that roof. We direct that roof runoff to the landscape, thereby doubling the available rainfall for the landscape. Then we look at the hardscape, our sidewalks, our patios, our driveways, and we slope all of them also to the landscape, not the street. By doing so, we then triple the amount of available rainfall from 4 to 12 inches of rain. Earthworks are the foundation strategy of a water sustainable earthwork. Okay, they don't just make rain go further, they make all sources of water go further, be it gray water, air conditioning condensate, evaporative cooler bleed off, reverse osmosis filter backwash, or municipal or well water. It is through the use of these earthworks that you all can meet the challenge that I have for you tonight. And that is, I want you to break from the unsustainable paradigm of water use and overconsumption, whereby we use potable drinking water to irrigate our landscapes. In the United States, about 30% of the potable drinking water that the average single-family household consumes is used to irrigate their landscapes. In Las Vegas, it's over 50%, as is the case in Denver, Colorado, San Diego, and Phoenix. That's a huge waste because we're spending billions of dollars purifying this water to drinking water standards and then delivering it to every household through miles and miles of pipes at drinking water quality. And then to cast it off into the dirt? But it gets even worse when you go inside the home. Because inside the home, over 25% of the potable water we consume there is in the toilet. We're literally crapping in drinking water. The dog knows what's going on. That's why it drinks from the toilet. I'm not going to do any more toilet talk. I think I've said enough there. But to come back to the landscape, we've talked about what the unsustainable paradigm of water use is. Now, the sustainable paradigm would begin in the landscape, where you don't have to worry about water quality and all of that. What I want you to do is, in the landscape, make rainwater the primary irrigator. Make gray water the secondary irrigator, and make municipal or well water only a supplementary source used in true times of need. Now, in case any of you don't know what gray water is, that is the water from any household drain except the toilet or the kitchen sink. Those are considered black water. And gray water is not the same as reclaimed water. Gray water is household drain water that's reused on site, using gravity to move it around. Reclaimed water is very expensive recycled water, which is drained to a sewage treatment plant, has been treated with a very elaborate process, and then pumped at great expense through miles and miles of pipe back to another site, typically golf courses or ball fields, but sometimes used in residential landscapes as well. And gray water is a much more sustainable way of recycling our wastewater than reclaimed water. Not to say we never should use reclaimed water, I'm just saying for household reuse, I don't think it's appropriate. Back to Africa, here we can see the family home. They have a metal roof. Water is drained from the metal roof into an above-ground ferro-cement tank. That is the primary potable drinking water source for the household. The overflow from the tank goes to a sunken basin in which a vine is planted. That vine then grows to shade and cool the tank. The cooler the temperature at which you store water, the higher the quality of that water. What's more, both the basin in which the vine is planted and the cistern double to slow spread and sink the flow of water. And they also both act as a windbreak, making for a more pleasant outdoor gathering area. And the vine is a food producer, so it's a living pantry of sorts. The next image, we see Mr. Peary beside some agave plants, and he's also standing on an earth and rock berm. These berms and plantings are laid perpendicular to the slope or on the contour. The slope is going that way. These run across. So if there is runoff on site, it accumulates behind these and infiltrates. So if you have a sloped site, these berms are one strategy you may want to use. Now we're back with Mr. Peary looking at what was once a very erosive gully. The water used to flow down, continually taking more soil with it, but he built a porous, low rock wall across it. It's meant to be leaky. It's no taller than 3 feet. That created a net in the flow that slowed the runoff enough that this level terrace of soil and organic matter accumulated behind it, thus filling in the once erosive gully. The potential of this can be tremendous. Native American activists put in a check dam about the same size in the Four Corners area of Arizona, and in one summer storm, there was so erosive a landscape that they accumulated a level terrace of sediment behind it in just that one storm. So they built another check dam upslope of it. There was one more rainstorm that summer, and it too carried enough sediment that it created a terrace behind it. The activists were thrilled that they had harvested this soil that otherwise would have washed out of the watershed, and they thought that would be the full extent of the benefits. But then something totally unexpected happened. 3 weeks later, an ephemeral spring appeared 30 yards downstream of the lower check dam. There had never been a spring there before. And that spring, it wasn't pouring out the water, it was just a seep. But it continued to seep water for 3 months. So this was not a year of high rainfall, this was a drought year of low rainfall. So how did this happen? It happened because they slowed the flow of water from the top to the bottom. That's the key to water harvesting, is you don't stop the flow, you don't hoard the flow. You're just slowing it down so it can infiltrate into the soil and more life forms can cycle through it more times in such a way that the water quality doesn't worsen. If anything, it stays the same, but what we strive for is for it to improve. Because of these strategies and because of that seep, plants, people, and wildlife could cycle and tap into this water for an additional 3 months that was never possible before. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I don't want you guys to think that if you do this, you're going to get a spring. Every site is unique. So what happened up on the Navajo lands is that level terrace of soil that accumulated behind the check dam acted as a sand tank. The water perked through it. It was more porous than the banks until the water hit the sandstone bedrock below. The water then migrated along the sandstone bedrock until it daylighted 30 yards downstream from the lower check dam. It varies. There, it was about 20 feet beneath the check dams. Yep. Clay can also act as a media over which water can move, but it can also infiltrate into the clay. So the key thing here is, let's say you have maybe caliche, maybe sandstone, or very porous soils. These strategies will benefit you either way, because what will be going on is you'll be infusing the soil with more water than would have been prior, and you will then enable the roots to access water for a longer period of time. It's going to fluctuate depending on the site, how much longer, how much water infiltrates, how much runs off. But you will be better off than before. Here we are back in Africa with Mr. Peary in the family compound. He's standing above his gray water reservoir. This is much too bleak for an American application, but it's working. I just want you to see that he's not only harvesting rainwater, he's also harvesting gray water. What you see is this little concrete sink where they do their laundry and their dishes. And then the drain from the sink drains to a subsurface chamber with no sealed bottom. It's just a soil bottom. It's in the top 2 feet of the soil, so the bulk of the water infiltrates where you have the most root growth and the most soil life to filter through it. But I'm going to show you an American example that uses the same concept, but is more lush. So this is a washing machine beside which we have four drain pipes. And each drain pipe is labeled with the fruit tree that the drain pipe is directed to. So we have fig, white sapote, orange tree, and peach tree. And every time we do a load of wash, we're standing at the washing machine and we take the drain hose from behind the washer and we move it to a different pipe, moving it in a clockwise fashion. So this way, we're always spreading the gray water around the landscape. We're never sending it always to the same spot. We keep sending it to a different spot. So we don't super saturate the soil with gray water. Instead, we spread the resource around. In a conventional household, you could have one more drain that would say sewer. And then in parentheses, it could say groundwater, because that's where it'll eventually go. If you're going to use any non-landscape appropriate soaps and detergents, like chlorine bleach, you could put the drain pipe in the sewer pipe. And then when you're using appropriate soaps, you can send it to the landscape. So here's a quick thing of rules. Don't use chlorine bleach if you're sending the water to the landscape. That'll kill your plants. Also, don't use powdered soaps or detergents, and don't use bar soaps. These use salt-based fillers to bulk up the product. Instead, use liquid soaps, both body and detergents, because they use water as the filling agent, so you're not adding any salt to the media. You can also get a lot more information on my website, harvestingrainwater.com. Just hit the gray water harvesting button, and you'll see a whole bunch of information on gray water reuse. As I go into gray water, I know every state is different with its laws, but I want you to know that both in Arizona and New Mexico, it is legal to harvest household gray water with no permit and no fee as long as you follow 13 simple guidelines. They're just common sense guidelines, which I also list on my website. Arizona has then notched it up yet another level. Starting January 1st of 2007, anyone implementing a rainwater or gray water harvesting system will qualify for up to a $1,000 state income tax rebate. And I strongly recommend that you push for your officials in Nevada to follow suit. The way this happened is it used to be illegal to harvest gray water in Arizona, but thousands of people were doing it anyway. So the University of Arizona decided to study the soil and the gray water and see if there was any significant health risk. They found there was not. So they took that information along with the huge volume of gray water that's produced. A household can easily produce 40,000 gallons of gray water a year. That is enough to irrigate at least 6 citrus trees. So they took the findings from the study and how much water is available with gray water to the officials, and they said, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Each one of these drain pipes then goes to a sunken, mulched, vegetated basin in the landscape. Okay, you never discharge gray water to the surface, and you never discharge gray water into a tank. If you put it into a tank, it turns septic. It becomes black water. So you want to send it within a living sponge of mulched, vegetated soil where the soil microorganisms immediately start to digest the organic matter and the bacteria. So the bacteria population never grows, it crashes. If you store the gray water in a tank, it skyrockets. So here, you're looking at a photo of a raised pathway that surrounds and slopes to a sunken, mulched basin that's lined with rock to keep the banks from eroding into the basin. And then here we have an artichoke that's just been planted, edible cactus, a Santa Cruz Huellia, and what you can't see right outside the frame is a big fig tree. When you are running a gray water pipe, you must maintain a 1/4 inch drop for every linear foot of pipe. That way, you have enough drop that gravity moves the water and nothing clogs the pipe. You can go steeper, you just can't go less steep than that. Oftentimes, you'll find that your pipe then daylights 2 inches above the mulch. That's great. That completes your system. The pipe just daylights and drops the water into a large basin that is sized to handle the peak surge of water. But in this case, the pipe daylighted below the level of the mulch. So what we had to do is we had to daylight the pipe within an air chamber. What you see here is a green bucket that's been placed upside down and a hole cut in the top so we can see what's going on. And then we cut a hole in the side of the bucket to send in the pipe. So the gray water is discharged into this 5-gallon empty bucket with no bottom, holes cut in the sides. So this white bucket you see to the side, that's what the green bucket looks like. The only reason this white bucket is here is so you can see what the green bucket looks like. And ordinarily, this flat rock is on top of the bucket, so you don't see the bucket, so it looks nice. And then nothing can fall into the bucket either. What will happen is the water will come through the pipe, it'll fill the bucket up, water will be perking down through the bottomless bottom, out the holes cut in the side, out the top under the rock, and then it would fill up the mulched basin. But all the water is retained within the basin, so there's no health problems or anything there, and it's all beneath the surface of the mulch. No standing water, no mosquitoes. The key thing is, this gray water pipe was discharged into a rainwater harvesting basin. You want to marry your rainwater and gray water harvesting strategies. So by first creating a basin that captures rainwater, you're getting that rain. And that salt-free rain will leach out the salts introduced via your soaps in the gray water. And then the gray water is on hand in the hot, dry months when you have no rainwater. So they complement each other. Here we're looking at the north side of my brother and I's home. You can see the fig tree, the orange tree, white sapote, and around the corners the peach. This is when the landscape was still pretty young. But you can see that all of these high water use plantings are easily within 30 feet of the house. And I never plant any high water users or even medium water users any further than 50 feet from the house, and usually not further than 30 feet from the house, because that 30-foot diameter, that's my oasis zone. That's where I have easy, convenient access to roof runoff and household gray water. Beyond that 30 feet, I only plant low water use native vegetation that can make it just on rainwater. This creates a much easier, efficient system. And then I don't have the birds predating on my fruit, because I'm here. The birds are hanging out in the native vegetation on the periphery where I'm not. So the whole system works better. You can go out into the desert and see the vegetation, the native vegetation, surviving just fine. But if you plant it within or beside earthworks, it's not just going to survive, it's going to thrive. And you can double the density and diversity because you've at least doubled the available rainfall. So don't think that a native landscape needs to seem very sparse and whatnot. It can be more lush than you might be accustomed to seeing. This is a Milagro co-housing development under construction in Tucson. It's a 28-unit high-end housing development. The roofs are all sloped. The metal roofs are all sloped to drain to about a 50-foot wide common landscape area. it's all been divided up into a whole series of basins. The slope slopes down that way, and should this basin ever fill with water, it'll overflow to the next basin, overflow the next, and so on, all the way to the bottom. These are high clay soils, so you are seeing standing water in the bare earth basins. 2 inches of rain fell in less than an hour just before this photograph was taken. But the key thing is here, this is under construction. The system is not complete. That's why you see standing water. You don't want standing water. So now let's jump to just 6 months later when the system was complete. All the basins have been well mulched and vegetated. Now, we had another 2-inch rainstorm in less than an hour. Happened shortly after all this had been done. And the water, all of it, infiltrated within an hour because we now had the living sponge in place. And every year, the water is going to infiltrate more rapidly because there'll be more roots, more soil life, more organic matter within and on top of the soil. The other great thing about this is this landscape has been set up so it is sustained after establishment, all this has now been established, to be irrigated only by harvested rainwater and household wastewater. No potable drinking water is being used on this landscape. And it's been set up so once mature, the fig trees back here that are only so big are now up to here. Once mature, it will produce over 100 pounds of organic produce per resident per year. Abundance, not scarcity. All right, this is an overview of the Milagro site. You can see what surrounds the common landscape is the homes. Within the common landscape is the gray area of a whole series of step basins, one into the next. The round circles are the trees. And then we have a parking lot separate from all the homes, because in a co-housing development, you keep cars away from the homes and the pedestrian area so it's safer for kids to run around and everything. And this also reduces the pavement on the development. This is a porous pavement of gravel on top of landscape fabric. So there's no runoff from the parking lot and there's no runoff from the housing development because the basins that make the foundation of the common landscape hold all the runoff from the roofs. As a result, there's no stormwater detention or retention basin at the bottom of this site. And it goes even further. We got a civil engineer to add up the cumulative storage volume of all these little basins and found it to be over 7 times the storage capacity of a conventional stormwater detention retention basin system. So the city and the county passed it right off. But it's not just controlling flooding. It's improving stormwater quality, it's improving recharge, and it's the foundation of the landscape so that it can be sustained primarily by rainwater and secondarily by the household wastewater. No, they're homes, owner-occupied homes built with local adobe bricks. The next principle of water harvesting is you want to always have an overflow and use the overflow as a resource. So here we have water coming off the roof into a cistern. Make sure the overflow pipe is at least as big as the inflow pipe. All too often I see outflow pipes that are too small and the system backs up. Don't direct the water randomly to any part of the yard, but direct it to a basin or another earthwork that will overflow to another earthwork and overflow behind another and then into another. This also meets the principle of flowing, spreading, and sinking the flow of water. We have a zigzag flow of water spreading it all over the yard and into the soil instead of a straight shot right out to the street. Now we're with Mr. Peary by a series of basins. He calls these pits. They're about 10 feet long, 6 feet wide, 4 feet deep. He calls these his fruition pits. So I said, well, why do you call it a fruition pit? He said, Brad, it grows fruit. And he snags some fruit from the bush growing within it. And he said, eat this. It's fruit. He stabilizes all his earthworks with all kinds of vegetation to grow food for him, his livestock, the wildlife, to create windbreaks, erosion control, and stabilize his earthworks. He used to have a whole lot of tall thatch grass here, but he had recently harvested that to sell for some money. So it was at this point that he said, Brad, do you realize this is not an ordinary plantation? I don't just plant plants. I plant the water. I plant it here, I plant it there, I plant it everywhere, so that it can germinate everywhere. Here, we're looking at a site again. You just saw the basins here, and now we're going to drop further into the fields the wind breaks below. You'll see the three hand-dug wells, and then we'll get to the reservoirs and the banana plantation. The next principle of water harvesting is you want to maximize your living and organic crown cover. Do not leave bare earthworks, do not leave bare soil. This whole obsession, or maybe fetish, with decomposed granite has got some real problems, because what happens is the decomposed granite has a lot of fines, a lot of clays. And if you have decomposed granite in the bottom of your basins or within your earthworks, it will seal the soil surface and it will reduce infiltration of water. Decomposed granite is fine to have on berms, to have on pathways or in formal gathering areas or patios, but do not place it in the areas where you want to recharge the water. Instead, those are the areas you want to vegetate, and those are the areas you want to mulch. This then gets a new mentality and a new management regime where we don't hit the leaves with the rake or the blower to just strip mine the nutrients out of the system. Instead, we allow the leaves to drop and accumulate, creating a regenerating mulch, and we have a closed nutrient loop. We're not mining the nutrients from that organic matter away. And what's more, these basin shapes, they naturally hold on to that organic matter, so you don't have it blowing all over the place. But we tend to plant on mounds and have our pathways in the low point, so of course there's leaves in the pathway. So we got to flip that around. And then as the roots grow, as I said before, you'll have more and more microchannels into the soil, more rapidly infiltrating the water. All this is about making things easier for you and making the cost of living lower. So yes, this is more work initially. You have to give things more thought, and you have to move more dirt. But in the long term, these earthworks will save you far more money, far more water, and resources. So once it's in place, you can hang out in the hammock. Here we are with Mr. Peary by his plant nursery. He grows out hundreds of trees in thrown away grain bags and sorghum beer cartons, which are like milk cartons. And he grows and places his trees in the shelter of existing trees. He gives away these for free to anyone that wants, so that people will revegetate the watershed. So I loved that whole concept until I heard that the bulk of the trees die. Sometimes upwards of 90% of the trees die. So when I heard this, I said to Mr. Peary, you know, that is an awful success rate. Why do you even bother if so many trees die? And to that, he stopped laughing, and he even slapped me on the shoulder. He said, Brad, don't you get it? At least 10% live, and we're much better off with that 10% than we would be without. Okay, I get it. But why do so many die? And he said, oh, it's because people love to plant trees, but almost nobody plants the water. And you've got to plant the water before you plant the trees. And the way you plant the water is with these earthworks. And the water you plant is the salt-free rain. The next slide shows the principle of stacking functions. You want all your water harvesting strategies to do more than harvest water. This way you get the biggest bang for the buck. And our water is so subsidized, when people look at the cost of the city water, they say, why, that, I don't know. I don't know if it makes sense to get a cistern to harvest the rain. Well, yeah, you're not paying that much for the city water, but how much are you paying for that Fiji spring water? Find out people are oftentimes paying upwards of $4 or more a gallon for water when they buy this bottled water. So it all depends on where your priorities are. Here we're seeing a cistern beside a house and the overflow from the cistern going to a sunken earthwork in which a tree is planted. Both the tree and the cistern are placed on the east or west side of the house, so they provide free passive shading and air conditioning. You can select that tree so it not only provides shade, but also it produces food, so it's a living pantry. The average American meal travels from 1,500 to 2,500 miles from farm to your plate. There's a huge amount of embodied energy and fossil fuel consumption in that. But yet, we can just step right outside our door for a lot of that food if we choose to grow it. Also, select vegetation that enhances wildlife habitat to enhance local ecosystem and enhance your view so you can see hummingbirds and butterflies outside your window. The earthwork and the cistern double as on-site stormwater control and stormwater quality enhancement. The EPA loves this, and you can get grant money to meet a lot of their requirements. And then the cistern can be set up to provide high-quality drinking water, or at the very least, the highest quality irrigation water. This is my brother and I's home right after we purchased it in 1994. What you're seeing is a 20-foot-wide bare earth public right-of-way, kind of like a moonscape, and then the fence to the right of that and the street to the left of it. When we moved here, people would just park in that right-of-way. There was no place really for the pedestrians to walk except the street. And we found that the rain, when it came off the roof, it would flood our house because our house was in a low point. But on this side of the yard, the water would flow out into the right-of-way, and then it would go into the street and contribute to severe flooding in our neighborhood. So what we did is we removed the asphalt driveways, and then we put in a big berm here to hold back the water, and we started digging out basins, took the dirt we dug out from the basins, and laid it in the path to make a raised pathway. By doing that, this turned into this in just 8 years. Nothing was taller than a 5-gallon plant when we planted it, and we did use supplemental water to irrigate to get the things established, but once the vegetation was established, we ceased all supplemental irrigation, and now this landscape, which is very lush, you've got tall trees and shrubs so dense you can no longer see the house, all this is just on rainwater and runoff. Now, we've got neighbors walking by. Not cars parking, so we're getting to know more of our neighbors. We're building community. They love walking through here. They say it's like the neighborhood botanical garden. In addition, we only had pigeons when we first moved to our property. Now we've got dozens of native bird species, such as cardinals, cactus wrens, Gila woodpeckers, gamble quail, verdins, and so on. That is because we planted the native vegetation. Over 95% of this is indigenous to the Tucson Basin. It's like the movie Field of Dreams, you know, build it and they will come. But we're not talking about making a baseball field in the middle of a cornfield to bring back dead baseball players. Instead, we're talking about planting the flora of the local ecosystem to bring on the fauna of the local ecosystem. And this is in downtown Tucson. We can now just step right outside our door and reconnect with the local ecosystem. Reconnecting with a sense of place. And it goes further than that. This is also a living orchard. We selected native species that would not only enhance things for the wildlife, but would also provide us with food and medicine. The ironwood trees, they provide peanut-flavored ironwood seeds, which we roast like peanuts. The mesquite trees have naturally sweet edible pods, which we grind up into flour with a mobile hammer mill. You can get more info on that at desertharvesters.org. The Palo Verde seeds, we harvest the barley-flavored seeds and the flowers, and much more. And then, these trees planted along the street are growing to shade and cool not only the walkway, but also the street itself, reducing the heat island effect, which is a major issue throughout the western United States. In Phoenix, Arizona, temperatures have risen 10 degrees since the 1940s due to the heat island effect. They've risen 6 degrees in Tucson. That's because we have all this bare hardscape, such as the asphalt, absorbing the heat during the day because it's not shaded, and then it radiates it out at night. It's predicted that in the next 20 years, the nighttime temperatures in Phoenix will not drop beneath 100 degrees in the peak of summer because of the heat island effect. That then necessitates people running their air conditioners or coolers even more, using more power, generating more heat, and for every day, an evaporative cooler uses about 65 gallons of water. Air conditioners use about the same amount of water, but that's at the power generation plant. We have cut the curb, so we take street runoff and direct it into these basins. There's one cut per basin. So this acts like an eddy in the flow. The street's crowned in the middle, so water flows along the curb. So we make one cut, and then water just fills up. When it fills up, it backs up on itself, and surplus water continues down the street. So it's a very simple, self-maintaining system. It's an eddy in the flow, not a channel. If we had a curb cut here and a curb cut here, water would erode and cut it out. So very careful on our design, and the pathway is at least as tall as the top of the curb, so no street runoff can flood adjoining properties. This is being done all over now. I strongly recommend you all do a web search on C Street Seattle, SEA Streets Seattle. Seattle, Washington, they're converting whole neighborhood blocks with this strategy. But they're going further. They're narrowing the street, so they reduce pavement by 11%. They make the street curvilinear so that it calms traffic. They only put in a sidewalk on one side of the street so that there's not as much pavement. And then they create lots of basins packed with native vegetation in all the remaining areas. They've reduced runoff by 98%, greatly enhancing the stormwater quality for the salmon populations in the area. And once the landscape's established, it's irrigated entirely by harvested rain and runoff. Property values are soaring where this is done, which is a mixed bag, but the quality of life is being enhanced. That's the important thing. And it's reducing heat island effect as the trees shade over the asphalt and sidewalks. Now we're back with Mr. Peary by one of his three hand-dug wells. He's laughing as he points down below, and he's telling me his family is now known as the family of water, into which they always have abundance that they can dip their fingers. Before he did this work, all three of his wells would go dry in dry seasons and drought. Since he's done this work, he always has at least one hand-dug well with abundant water, even in the most severe dry seasons and droughts. And he's found that on average, his well levels are going up, as are those of his immediate neighbors to either side and those downstream. Yet, his more distant neighbors, who have much deeper wells, find that their well levels continue to drop, and in dry seasons and drought, they are dry. The difference between Mr. Peary and his more dry distant neighbors, is that he gives back more than he takes. When it rains, he does all he can to make deposits in the soil. He puts as much of the water as he can back into the watershed. And if you look at his budget throughout the year, he puts far more water into the soil than he takes out. He makes more water deposits than he makes of withdrawals. But his more dry, distant neighbors never make a deposit. They don't have any earthworks, no cisterns. All they do is continually go to the ATM machine of the water bank, known as the well, and they make withdrawal after withdrawal after withdrawal, robbing savings of old and robbing the savings of future generations. And that is what we're doing throughout the Western United States, is we are just withdrawing, but we're not depositing. By giving back more than he takes, Mr. Peary has created the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And they are there within his soil. He accesses them with his hand-dug well, the reservoirs, which you'll see in just a moment, and his vegetation. The rivers are the lens of groundwater he has created within his soils through all these earthworks. Here we are at the bottom of a site beside one of the three reservoirs. This is the middle reservoir. When he dug out this reservoir, he hit water. He hit the groundwater that he had created, that he had infused into the soil. So this is literally his water gauge. And it ebbs and flows depending on the season, but he's growing fish in here. That's why it's so low. Typically it's much higher. He surrounds the reservoir with tall vegetation and trees to shade it to reduce evaporation and to reduce wind blowing over it and the ripple effect, which would cause more evaporation. So his more dry, distant neighbors, they too could likely be raising fish if they chose to implement these strategies. But as it is, many of them are dying of hunger and thirst in the droughts. And in the severe droughts, the water will dry up from the lower reservoir. Mr. Peary pulls all the fish up into the higher, the middle one. And then the upper reservoir goes dry, and he pulls all that into the middle one. And then if that goes dry, he calls all the neighbors and has a massive community fish fry. And here he is in his banana plantation just down slope of the reservoirs. He does not apply surface irrigation to these. They're dry farm. They're irrigated entirely with the moisture harvested within the soil. So I was amazed to see this and all the work he had done. Then I said, how long did it take to do all this? And he said, well, it took about 30 years. I said, 30 years? That is such a long time. And the second time that day, he stopped laughing. And he again slapped me on the shoulder. And he said, Brad, that's life. Life is a slow process. You just have to start. And you start with long and thoughtful observation. You start at the top of your watershed and you work down. You start with small and simple strategies. You start by slowing, spreading, and sinking the flow of water. You start by maximizing your living and organic ground cover. You start by making sure all your water harvesting strategies do more than just harvest water. And you make sure that all your water harvesting strategies have an overflow and you use the overflow as a resource. And then you start with the last principle, which is the same as the first, long and thoughtful observation. Or said another way, the feedback loop. You want to see what's working about your system and build on that. What's not working, change that. Because this is not a static system. It's a living system. And we all are just another living organism among many that makes up the system as a whole. But you all are a living organism that has this amazing ability to make a choice. And it's my hope that you all choose for your buns to dance. Thanks. If there's any questions, my books, Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands, Volume 1. Mr. Peary's story is the core of Chapter 1, but I have many other case studies in urban, suburban, and rural contexts showing you how to realize all the principles. There's a whole other set of principles specific to cistern systems, and I give lots of calculations to figure out gray water harvesting systems, cistern sizing, and so on. And there's a whole chapter dedicated to how you can create an integrated design that harvests far more than water. Or you can get your water harvesting strategies to also passively heat and cool your home to grow food, reduce erosion, and so on. I also have Art Ludwig's latest gray water book, which is the best one out there because it includes his branch drain system, which I think is the best system. And the website harvestingrainwater.com that has a lot of free resources.
This was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can visit us on the web at lasoundposse.org.